British Spy Stories, Season 2, The Kill Order. Episode 26. All morning, Gabby, Hans and Panama have been planning their defence operations for the house. Hans is in charge of munitions and has run cables up each side of the driveway and wired it all back to a control station in the hallway of the mansion. Panama has focused on arms distribution. He and Gabby have gone through all the possible ingress points for Babu's men and the defence plan for each scenario. By lunchtime, Hans remains very keen and excited about the fieldwork, but Panama is visibly less enthusiastic and talks about having other things to do. Gabby takes sandwiches up to him to change over shifts on the lookout post in the roof. He grunts a thanks, then they sit in silence while he eats.
Vita,
she says after a while, and he looks at her.
You happy?
Yeah.
No, really,
she says.
You've been talking like you're bored.
I don't like all this waiting.
What would you rather be doing?
Finding Babu, killing him, says Panama. That'll solve it all. Then he can't find Jacob or Arena.
He could be a sorceress in the Balkans.
So how is keeping his son in this house helping that?
Bait,
she says, and watches his eyes.
The boy will be fine, but it's a lever to get Babu to agree to a deal.
The hologram too?
Designed to piss him off,
she says.
Men like that are driven by always trying to have more. Once they have money and sex and guns and land and power, they just want more of it all. It's all they know in the end. More of the same. It's an addiction.
Panama is silent and mildly shakes his head. After a few moments' pause, he says,
Some mates of mine messaged me. They're going for a drink tonight. So when I've finished, I'm going to mince for a few beers.
He pitches his words between seeking her approval and just stating what he's doing.
Good idea, she says. Get away for an evening. He's not coming tonight.
And you know that because?
When I saw him yesterday, he was still in planning mode, still thinking through his options. If he'd been ready to move against us, he would have had quite a different attitude. Vita, there's something else,
she says.
I need you to spring the trap.
How?
Tonight, I'll give you the address of a bar to go to, with your friends. It's a place where London Control has discovered that Babu's men go in the evening.
You want me to tell them location of this place?
Let me tell you how it's going to work. Then you can go and have your beers.
Ella's cousin is out on a date with her new boyfriend tonight, and will probably not be back until the morning. Ella opens a bottle of red wine and sits in the twilight of the day with a glass in her hand. She swirls the red liquid around so she can see its true colour, like her father taught her. The window at the end of Edie's lounge overlooks the lane and the road junction at the bottom of the hill. Ella is sitting there so she has a good view of anyone arriving by road. At just before 6:15, a black Jaguar Sentinel appears at the junction. It swings up the hill and comes to a halt outside the cottage. Ella opens the front door and the driver is walking round to open the rear door. Sir Bernard is inside.
Let's go for a drive, he calls to her. I want to see some of the landscape while I'm here.
She collects a coat from behind the door and steps across the path to the car. Sir Bernard asks her how she is, and she relates the events earlier today when she thought she might have been followed. He reassures her and says not to worry. The Jaguar glides through the lanes and up the hills without effort. After half an hour, they arrive at Malham Cove, a giant grey bluff of limestone, with water cascading down a sheer drop to the rock below. Percy, the driver, stops the car, and Ella and Sir Bernard both climb out into the fading light.
I used to come here as a boy, he says. My father loved Yorkshire. We used to walk across these hills. Stayed in remote farmhouses, just the four of us. I have a brother.
He stops and looks at her.
older,
she says.
Can you tell?
I guess.
Happy times, says Sir Bernard.
I haven't been back since.
They continue walking without words for a minute.
I wanted to tell you about the plan we have for you.
They are near the falling stream now.
You've been cleared for Top Secret Plus, so I can tell you now that Marjorie Allardyce is an agent for the Russian FSB. She was recruited by Moscow at university. We found out 10 years ago. Every role she has, every message she sends, is monitored. But only a handful of people know that she is a foreign agent. I had hoped to turn her a few years ago and make her a double, but it wasn't possible. She's been useful. She helped us expose another Russian agent at the highest level of MI6 only 6 months ago.
How is it possible that she's useful to you, sir?
Oddly, foreign agents who think they are hidden in your own spy agency are more reliable than your own people.
I don't understand.
What's the role of a foreign agent?
Find your secrets and tell their bosses.
Exactly, says Sir Bernard. They are guaranteed to act in a certain way. If you give them information that seems to be full of confidential material, you can bet your bottom dollar it will get back to Moscow or wherever they come from.
But you said they're unusually reliable. Aren't our own spies reliable too?
She says.
What we have learnt, starting way back with Burgess, Philby and MacLean in the '50s, is that your own people can be turned. They could start off well-meaning, but they get offers or can be blackmailed by foreign powers. We do it to others, so it's natural that they do it to us. But a foreign agent, embedded in our own service, is reliably leaky.
Ella smiles at him.
Every country has spies. We have spies in Moscow, and they have spies here.
We all know that there are small-scale intelligent gathering operations going on all the time. We try and get their military secrets, and they try and get ours. Some of that data is accurate, and some is not. That's the game.
The art is to know which bits are true, he says.
I see now. But why are you telling me all this?
I want you to act as though nothing has changed. Go and talk to Marjorie. You're sad about Stefan, of course, but you want to help her. You'll feed her intelligence that will contain elements of the truth to make it appear realistic, but the critical parts will be fiction.
Ella's face is serious.
You can say no, he says.
Will I be in danger?
No more than no. And we'll be there with you, in the dark, making sure it all goes okay.
Is this a point of no return?
She says.
Difficult to go back, certainly. I remember when I was offered a field ops job. I wasn't clear if it's what I wanted, but I thought, you only live once, so why not?
And did it turn out as you thought?
Not at all. It was full of unplanned things. Events I could never have imagined. If you want predictability, maybe this isn't for you.
I don't know if I do,
she says. They pause their conversation. Then, she turns to Sir Bernard.
I'll do it.
The auburn yellow of the whiskey in front of him gives Marcus a feeling of security. His brain is awash with questions and increasingly desperate ideas about how he can solve his current set of problems. He's still worried about the girl in the room, particularly because he has no memory of what happened beforehand, or how he ended up there. He hasn't been into work since then because he doesn't want to report his missing ID badge. It contains an embedded chip that gives access to Vauxhall Cross, and that thought makes him swig back the rest of the drink and raise his hand for another. After half an hour, he leaves the bar and starts to walk through the streets of Soho. He can vaguely remember the location of the room where he woke up, and he tries to retrace his steps. Maybe his ID will be there, under the bed or behind the dressing table. Maybe everything will work out. He walks the length of Wardour Street and turns off just before he reaches Chinatown. He goes down one alley, then another, then sees the dead end he had seen from the bedroom window. There's a door in the wall. He tries the handle, and it's open. Marcus climbs the stairs and stands on the landing in front of the bedroom doorway, then puts his ear to the wood. But there's no sound. His fingers clench the handle, and he twists his wrist. The room is exactly as he left it, except the girl has gone. Marcus starts a fingertip search, starting from the corner by the window. He methodically looks in every nook and cranny, in every drawer, under every ornament. He looks under the bed, rips the cover off the mattress, scours the sheets and inspects the pillowcases. He moves the furniture away from the wall in search of his possessions. But he doesn't find anything. He also doesn't hear the door open and someone enter.
Looking for something?
Marcus looks up. It's the woman he had woken up next to. Her blonde hair is tied up in a bun. Yesterday's mascara is clogged on her lashes. And a cigarette trails smoke from between two fingers of her left hand.
My wallet, he says. And my ID. I must have left them here.
She says nothing.
Did you see anything after I'd gone?
I'd rather talk about what you did to me.
She pulls up her vest top to show the bruises on her stomach.
I didn't do that.
You fucking did,
she says. She pauses for an instant, then adds,
Mr. Spy?
What?
Says Marcus, trying to act.
Found your ID, didn't I? Got it in a safe place, too.
Great, then let's go and get it.
She laughs to herself.
That's worth quite a bit, I'd say. I'm guessing you'd be willing to cough up a fair wage for it, am I right?
Of course not, it's already cancelled. It's worthless now, but I'd like it back.
I may fuck for a living, but I ain't stupid. Marcus Murphy.
How much, then?
Grand.
I'll give you 200, because I feel sorry for you.
What about my damages for you kicking me in the stomach?
She says.
My bloke says he'll find you and kick you in more than just your stomach.
There's no proof I did any of that,
says Marcus.
I suspect your boyfriend did it, and you're just trying to get more cash.
The woman shrugs.
Don't blame me when you've got no teeth, Marcus.
She takes a slow drag from her cigarette and lets the smoke curl out of her mouth and away to the ceiling.
300,
he says.
That's all you're getting.
Got it on you,
says the woman. He shakes his head.
There's a cash machine in Wardour Street. 10 minutes, then back here.
Marcus moves around her and out through the door. He walks to the cash machine, presses the buttons, pushes the notes into his back pocket, and walks back to the room. The woman is there. He counts the cash into her hand, and she hands him his ID. He's about to say something final to her, when his head suddenly feels like it's splitting with pain. Then he feels his legs collapsing, and blackness washes through his consciousness.